Peter Donat. In the previous program of Transformations of Myth Through Time, Campbell revealed how a mystical reading of religious symbols beyond the purview of reason was condemned as heresy by the Eastern Fathers of the Christian Church. Rejected was the idea of a non-rational experience of God. The literal, historical interpretation of the life of Christ became the only accepted truth. The religious experience was to be codified. Man in relationship to God, regulated by the institution of the church. And so it was to be until the rediscovery of the individual, the divine power in one's heart, which burst upon the world in the unique tales of the Arthurian romances. This program is the first of three on these stories, which emerged suddenly in the middle of the 12th century and remain to this day the central myth of Western civilization.
Well, our particular topic today, the Grail, is one that I think can serve to guide us from the general universal themes of myth into the material specifically of the European consciousness which we inherit. The period of the Arthurian and Grail romances is dated almost precisely from 1150 to 1250 AD. And in the historical context of this second great phase of Occidental culture, the first phase being that of the Greco-Roman period, starting with the Homeric epics, the period of the Arthurian romances is the counterpart for the Gothic and modern worlds of the Homeric period for the Greco-Roman. That is to say, it is in that period that the main themes are stated and developed in terms of culture values and the spiritual dimensions. The great works appear suddenly. This is a remarkable thing about the dawn of civilizations. Within 200 years, the whole thing is there, and it wasn't there before. There was the material, but not this particular constellating of it. And so I want to talk first about the backgrounds of the Arthurian world. Now, Europe had four powerful mythological traditions in full career before the introduction of Christianity. There was the classical Greek, classical Italic or Roman, there was the Celtic material, and there was the Germanic. And they were in full strength. And they represented something that is typical to Europe and of nowhere else, and that is respect for the individual and the individual path, the individual way. The Greeks already recognized their distinction from the world of the ancients and what they call the Orient. In precisely this recognition of the individual, and the idea of a member of a society as a citizen instead of as a subject is Greek. Now, in the European Gothic, this goes a step further. The sense of the individual path was very, very strong. I'm going to be talking about the Grail this afternoon. There are three great Grail romances. There are more than that, but there are three that are the top great ones. The earliest was of Creighton of Troy, Christian de Troyes. 1180, 1190 in there, the Percival of Creighton. And the second, and the one that I want to talk about, which is the great one, is of Wolfram von Eschenbach, Parzival. This is the one that Wagner took over and changed. This date for this is around 1210. And then these are the Grail romances of the heroic view, the heroic knight, Percival, married man and a self-motivated figure. And then there is another Grail romance. It's the one that Mallory gives us in the Morte d'Arthur in English. He translated it from Old French, a text known as the Quest del Saint Graal, in Old French, who pronounced the last consonant and so forth. The Quest del Saint Graal, the quest of the Holy Grail. And this was written by a Cistercian monk whose name we do not know. And it was followed by a work by another Cistercian monk, L'Estoire, the History del Saint Graal, of the Holy Grail, where the Grail is interpreted as the vessel of the Passion of Christ, the cup of the Last Supper, and the cup, the same cup, that received his blood when his body taken from the cross was washed of its wounds and the blood taken in the Grail. I will talk about these at some length. But here we have the two traditions in Europe. One, you might say, the heroic one, which is the native one of Europe, going back to the old Germanic, Celtic spirit, and then the applied Christian one, which is brought in from the Near East. And the thinking and value system of the Near East was precisely the opposite, and has been and remains precisely the opposite to that of Europe. There it is one's membership in the community that counts. One is not an individual, one is a member of a society. One is an organ in an organism. Everything is done. Enormous emphasis on ritual, rules, laws. Read the law books of the Old Testament, Leviticus. You see what it is. This tradition was brought into Europe and applied by military force in the 4th and 5th centuries AD. You have an enormous dislocation. By the 11th and 12th centuries, the ones that we're going to be talking about, Europe is beginning to assimilate this material. And the Grail story, the Arthurian romances, represent this assimilation. Those are beautiful years, 1150 to 1250. Why does it suddenly stop? You've all heard of the Inquisition. College of Cardinals telling you what to think, what God thinks, and how you are to relate to it, instead of this other experience, namely, of the divine power operative in your own heart. The Grail romance is of the God in your own heart. And the Christ becomes a metaphor, a symbol, for that transcendent power which is the support and being of your own life. This is why we're going to get in the Grail. Now, with respect to the Quest del Saint Graal, the quest of the Holy Grail, the opening tells of the knights of Arthur's court in the great dining hall. And Arthur will not let the meal be served until an adventure will have occurred. Now, in those days, adventures occurred. And so no one thought he was going to go away without food. And the adventure in this case was that the Grail appeared, carried by angelic messengers hovering above the company. And it was covered over with a cloth. And everyone sat there in rapture. And the grail was then withdrawn. That was the adventure. And Gawain, there's a name that's going to be occurring all day, Gawain, the nephew of King Arthur, stood up and said, I propose a quest. I propose that we now should go in quest of that grail, each to behold it unveiled, without the veil. And then there occurs in the old French text, in the quest, and this is, for some reason or other, a passage that Mallory did not translate, but it's one that seems to me to epitomize the whole sense of the grail symbology. The text says, they agreed, all would go on this quest, but they thought it would be a disgrace, this is the word, to go forth in a group. Think of the group psychology that the tradition of the from the Orient represents. They thought it would be a disgrace to go forth in a group. Each entered the forest of the adventure, at a point that he himself had chosen, where it was darkest, and there was no path. Now, all of you who have had anything to do with Oriental gurus know that they have the path. And they know where you are on the path. And some of them will give you their own picture to wear, to know where to get to, instead of your picture. Yeah? This is the difference, and this is Europe. So they entered the forest at the point that they had chosen, where there was no path. If there is a path, it is someone else's path, and you are not on the adventure. Now, what are you to do about instruction? You can get clues from people who have followed paths, but you have then to carom off that and translate it into your decision. And there is no book of rules. In this wonderful quest, it's a marvelous romance, each knight going his own way. On this wonderful quest, when anyone finds the path of another and thinks, oh, he's getting there, and begins to follow that, he goes astray totally, even though the other may get there. This is a wonderful story. That which we intend, that which is the journey, that which is the goal, is the fulfillment of something that never was on the earth before, namely, your own potentialities. Every thumbprint is different from every other. And every cell and structure in your body is different from that of any that has ever been on earth before, so you have to work it out yourself. And you take your clues from here and there. So with that beginning, I want now to, with some slides to illustrate the story, indicate some of the backgrounds, the historical depth of background that underlies these traditions of the West, which are going to be illustrated in the Arthurian romances. And then, after a break, after I finish this little historical review, or pre-historical review, I'll move into the two great stories of this tradition. One, the story of Tristan and Isolde. This is the story of love as the guide, love as a divine infusion, and the date for the early troubadours, and these are the first to celebrate this, That begins 1100. The 12th century is the troubadour century. And the great theme was what is known as courtly love, which was by definition adulterous love. The marriage of the courts of the day was a marriage arranged by the family, not by an individual choice. And that's the kind of marriage that predominates to this day in the East. And it was the kind of marriage of the ancient world. Two people who've never seen each other before are joined in marriage. And the church then sacramentalizes this and says, two bodies, one flesh. What it really is, two bank accounts, one bank account. And you don't have the electrification of love at all. You may have a very warm and genial social relationship, production of children and all of that sort of thing. Love entered such a situation as a destiny, and a terrifying destiny, because the social response was death. There's a wonderful moment in the Gottfried von Strasbourg Tristan, which is the Tristan that Wagner took over, where this young couple, by accident, has drunk the love potion. Tristan is bringing Isolde back to Cornwall from Ireland, she's a Dublin girl, to marry his uncle, King Mark. When the two of them drink this, a couple of kids about 15 years old, having no idea what had happened to them, they begin to feel sick. They don't know what it is. And Isolde, who's the women are faster than boys, apparently, catching on to what's going on here, she says, je crois que c'est la mer. And she pronounces la mer as though it were l'amour, you know, it's in between. Is it the sea? Are we seasick? Or is this what's called love? And the whole sense of this courtly idea was that the pain of love, unless you got it in the gut and can hardly bear it, it hadn't happened. The idea was to feel. The Buddha says all life is sorrowful. This is the experience of the pain of being alive. Where your pain is, that's where your life is. So find it. And here it comes. Well, they've just about caught on to what's happened to them. When Brangaine, the nurse who has been sent over with Isolde by her mother, whose name also was Isolde, whipped the love potion, which was supposed to be drunk by Isolde and King Mark. The maid was the one who didn't pay close attention and left it unguarded, and the couple drank it, thinking it was wine. When she realizes what has happened, she's appalled, and she goes to Tristan and says to Tristan, you have drunk your death. There's this wonderful line in the Gottfried version. Tristan says, I don't know what you mean. If by death you mean the pain of my love for Isolde, that's my life. If by death you mean the punishment that I am to suffer from society, I accept that. If by death you mean eternal damnation in hell, I accept that. Now there's the individual experience refuting in value the whole system. And that's what these people represented. We're dealing with something serious here. So I want, in the morning after I finish this historic review, to talk about the Tristan problem. And you see what that leaves. It leaves a tension between the social order, which is imported, implanted, and put on you, and the individual life. They don't go together. The word amor, spell it backwards, you get. Amor is the Provençal form of amour. Spell it backwards, you get Roma. Roman Catholic Church and its sacrament, amor, the individual experience. By what kind of magic can people put God in your heart? They can't. It's either there or not there out of your own experience. That's the sense of this thing. Consequently, when we come to the Grail, to Wolfram von Eschenbach's Grail, there's the problem of coordinating these two. The theme of the Grail is the bringing of life into what is known as the wasteland. The wasteland is the preliminary theme to which the Grail is the answer. Now, T.S. Eliot in 1924, five or six in there, had his key poem, The Wasteland. What is the sense of the wasteland in medieval terms and in T.S. Eliot's terms? It's exactly the same sense. It's the world of people living inauthentic lives, doing what they're supposed to do. In the 12th century, they had to profess beliefs that they may or may not have held. They had to love in marriage people that they may or may not have learned to love. They had to behave this way, that way, the way the cardinals told them to behave. And as you'll see, when Parsifal fails in the Grail adventure, he fails because he's doing what he's been told to do instead of what his heart told him to do. That's the problem of the question. We'll come to that later. So what I want first to do is to give some sense of the fantastic tradition and the levels and levels of culture that have piled up in Europe, which is the, not the youngest, it's the oldest culture in the world. Going way back to the caves, Lascaux and all, those caves date from 30,000 BC, and there's nothing like them on the planet for many, many millennia afterwards. Then on top of that comes the Neolithic tradition, the tradition of the planting people, the early planting people. Then come the Great Bronze Age tradition. Then come the invading Indo-European warrior tradition. Then comes the Roman tradition. Then come the Christian tradition. I mean, one thing piled right on top of the other. So I'm going to give a view of that, and then we'll move into these two great stories, Tristan for this morning, and the Grail for this afternoon. Here is a 14th century representation of Merlin and Arthur. Merlin is the great guru of the Arthurian world. He had the whole program for him in his mind. And the world of the Arthurian knights was a world of two great stages or periods. The first was that of Christianizing or civilizing, you might say, the wild, Iron Age, barbaric world of Europe. And then after the establishment comes the age of the individual journey, the individual adventure. Now, Merlin is a purely fictional figure. He's associated with Druid mysteries. He's a sort of a late manifestation of the Druid tradition. The Druids were the priests and spiritual guardians of the Celts. The Celts come into Europe in the first millennium BC. There are two stages of the Celtic entry. They come from Bavaria, across France and Switzerland, and into the British Isles. The first stage is known as the Hallstatt culture. It's a heavy, you might say, ox car culture, where these herding people with their families in ox wagons come slowly into the European wilderness and domesticate it. Then there comes a period beginning around 500 BC that's known as the Latene, L-A, and then another word, T-E-N-E, Latene culture, with its center in southern France and Switzerland. Brilliant chariot warrior fighters. And these are the people that then go up into the British Isles. Now, the people who had been in Europe before were pre-Celtic, pre-Indo-European. And their tradition may go back all the way to the caves. But the great period of their flowering before the incoming of the Indo-Europeans is that of Stonehenge. Now, the dates for Stonehenge ranges earlier and later than around the date 1500. There are three or four different stages of the building of Stonehenge. In the medieval tradition, Merlin is supposed to have brought the stones to Stonehenge. This is in Algiers, from the same period. You recognize this? This is Mycenae. Now, the way these uprights and the crossbeam are put together here is exactly the way they're put together at Stonehenge. At the top of this, there is a little bulb, a little wart, so to say, and then there's a socket in the crossbeam, and they're put together that way. And that's the way they are at Stonehenge. So Stonehenge is of approximately the date, at least the great Saracen range of Stonehenge, of Mycenae, which is the middle of the second millennium BC. This is the period of the High Bronze Age. This is the period of the great dynasties of Imperial Egypt. In the Bronze Age, well, you know, bronze is an alloy. There are two kinds of bronze. One is an alloy of copper and arsenic, and the other is an alloy of copper and tin. The tin alloy was the one that was most used and important. Wherever tin was found, there was a settlement of people mining the tin. And one very important one for this whole world was in Transylvania here. Another was Cornwall. There was tin in Cornwall, and there was a settlement in Cornwall. And so the people who were working it were the people of the British Isles. Back, second millennium BC is the beginning. Now here in Mycenae is that great mound that is known as Agamemnon's treasury. Actually, it was a great burial mound, enormous. Now, following that track of the passage across the Mediterranean, we come to southwest Spain, and here is a similar mound in Spain. Then we go up to Ireland, and here is New Grange in Ireland. You can visit it. It's only a couple of hours' drive from Dublin. The date is around 2000 BC, 2000 to perhaps even 2500 BC. So we have this, what I'm trying to bring out here is, though we're way up in the marginal, the ultimate marginal northwest of Europe, we're in immediate connection with the high cultures of Egypt, Mesopotamia, and Syria there. This is 3000 to 2000 BC in that area there. That's the deep ground.